Coming up this week on the Course of Life podcast, our front nine gave us a return major champion and a breakthrough lefty W on the PGA Tour. Plus, this week, I head to Houston to see what the LIV Golf fuss is all about. And this week's guest is five-time PGA Tour winner Billy Mayfair. Yes, an awesome blast from the past name. He's out there on the PGA Tour champions, and he has an amazing story to tell as well. And we get into an NBA Finals preview, Caitlin Clark, baseball, and when we always end with food, we're talking collard greens and cheap bar food eats. All of it brought to you by our friends at Desert Fox Golf. And we are officially 2 weeks away from Father's Day. This is absolutely the time to hit that button on the Father's Day gift. I know right now you're probably thinking, oh geez, we're getting close to the Father's Day deadline. All you need to do is go to desertfoxgolf.com, put in the promo code Course of Life when you buy anything from their site. Get their phone caddy. It's a really good, awesome way for the father or golfer in your life to hold their phone and keep it safe on the course. They also have Swing Aid tumblers to hold their drink, DJ 10 speakers to keep the music going throughout their round. These are the easy Father's Day golf gifts that you need right now in your life. So again, go to desertfoxgolf.com, promo code Course of Life, see everything Desert Fox Golf has to offer, and get the best gift for your father this Father's Day.
Interwebs, and welcome to Course of Life. We are proud to be presented by our friends at Desert Fox Golf. I'm Michael, he's Alex. And Alex, there was carnage this weekend.
Yes, a real U.S. Open.
I love it. Country Club, U.S. Women's Open, and the headline, there's so many different headlines we can talk about to talk about the carnage, but I feel like the headline that encompasses what happened at Lancaster Country Club this week is the bird that was killed on the 12th hole on Thursday.
Yes, I guess that was a very tiny micro encapsulation of what was to come, because that happened on Thursday, and we immediately started to see how difficult this course was playing. And then the other Thursday headline we got was from our friend, world number one, Nelly Korda, you know, on top of the world. Got to be the prohibitive favorite to win this past week at Lancaster. Makes a 10 on a par 3 and shoots 10 over par for two rounds. That's how you knew there was going to be some carnage this week at the U.S. Open.
It's just unbelievable. She went in the water, what, three times on, I think it was it 12, actually?
Yeah. One of us on the par three there. She made a 10, 7 over par on one golf hole. I commented on her Instagram, and you'll see it because it's a top comment there. I said, thanks for being relatable for 1 week. You can go back to being Nelly now for the rest of the season. Yeah. A lot of the best players in the world struggled. Lexi Thompson off of the retirement announcement, 13 over. Our girl Rose Zhang, 9 over, missing the cut. So she wasn't the only one. Everyone could get it in terms of the course that the carnage this course offered. And this was the throwback. You know, you and I grew up on U.S. Opens of the 90s and 2000s, where even par was a dang good score every single day. And that's what that felt like this week.
And, you know, it looked like we were going to have an interesting little shootout here. We had five players at 5 under par to start a Sunday.
Yep.
Andrea Lee, I'm going to mispronounce because I do this on the LPGA Tour. Yep. Wichani Miche.
Nice job, Miche. Okay. Good job. There you go.
And Minjae Lee.
Yep, all absolutely. Sister of Minwoo Lee. Yep.
Andrea Lee, 5 over on the day. Miche, 7 over par on the day. And Lee, 8 over par on the day. So it ended up going to Japan's Yuka Saso, who gets her second U.S. Women's Open.
Gutsy. Victory. Yeah, Team Callaway player who's been around. You've seen her name float around some leaderboards for a few years, but coming back when it mattered most again at the National Championship. And Mike, I got to say it, let's just be real. The way the prize money works in the LPGA, if there is one tournament you want to win all year, thanks to our friends at the USGA, it's the U.S. Women's Open, because that is the biggest pot of the year for the women golfers out there. So shout out to Yuka Saso for getting it done a second time amidst all the chaos and carnage. Again, just a really kind of fun throwback U.S. Open where par really mattered, birdie was hard to find, and it definitely showed a deserving champion.
I feel like what this says is that we need to put the men at Lancaster.
Right. And then tip it out and make the greens twice as fast. And let's watch the world burn. Let's do it.
I love it. The world was not burning north of the border in Canada for the RBC Canadian Open, where I think the press seemed to really want to say that Rory McIlroy was going to win this. He went 66 to open. He was in position. Then he had 72 on Friday. And then he went 65, 64 to finish. Not good enough.
No,
but not but good his, enough. His neighbor, his country neighbor, Robert McIntyre, was able to secure his first PGA Tour victory.
Yeah, Lefty Bob, who you hear me affectionately call out many times over. I've loved to ride him and haven't quite found a winner with him betting-wise for one of his wins. He's poked through over in the DP World Tour, but awesome to see him get this maiden victory. And very sentimental because he had his dad on the bag. We're heading into that Father's Day season, like we mentioned at the top of the episode. So it was really cool to see dad, who got very emotional at the end. You know, that's a special moment for him. It's a scenario that he'd often kind of watch from the sidelines, wondering if he'd ever be a part of that. And lo and behold, dad's there on the bag for the first PGA Tour win and the biggest win professionally of Robert McIntyre's career. So great to see Lefty Bob pull through there.
That was indeed. Tom Kim broke the top five as well. See if that young phenom can keep breaking barriers here and see what he can do. Canadians Corey Connors and Mackenzie Hughes also had top 10 finishes. No Canadian for 2 years in a row. That would have been something to see a Canadian win it 2 years in a row after not winning it forever.
Good finishes there from those two, though. Nice job.
But there you go. Joel Damon, too, top 10 finish. He couldn't really finish it out here on the weekend. What do we think? Is he turned a corner? He said his putting's been doing really well here. Is he no longer the worst golfer on tour?
Right. I know he's one of those guys that we're just kind of all rooting for a little bit more than the average golfer. I feel like we're going to get a nice full recap of this entire week on Netflix Full Swing in about 8 months from now.
But
this was definitely a breakthrough for him. So I don't know. You know, it's just a couple missed putts here and there. He's often said he's a bit of a spraying golfer. So if he's keeping himself accurate off the tee, hopefully we see him on more leaderboards this year.
Other PGA Tour news, Scotty Jailbird Scheffler will not have to go to court. The charges were dropped in Louisville for him supposedly dragging the cop. The footage that we saw didn't match the description of events.
Mike, those $80 pants are beyond repair.
I know, beyond repair, beyond repair. Calm, very calm. Courteous responses from both Scotty and the cop who put out statements afterwards. But Scotty's lawyer went full fire and brimstone.
Yeah, he had the victory, you know, so while he had the win, he figured he might as well fire off a couple more shots on the way out of the club, basically. And he definitely was defending his client beyond the courtroom. Good to see that defense. And obviously, we kind of all saw the video piece by piece thrown together that showed Scotty be basically 10 to 15 more percent more innocent with every different video clip and body cam that came out. And by the time every angle emerged, we saw that it was exactly how he described, just a horribly mistimed miscommunication that really threw the golf world for a loop.
Yeah. So Louisville's finest, maybe not. I don't know. It's unfortunate. There we go. Scotty doesn't have to go to jail. We'll see him on the course next.
Yeah.
Speaking of being on the course.
Yep.
You're making the drive. What is it, like 8, 9, 10 hours for you to get to
Houston?
Right,
yeah, 8, 9, 10, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yep. And you're going to go to the enemy's event. You're going to a live event.
All right, I'm checking it out, Mike. You know, I'm nothing if not diplomatic. I want to see all sides of the coin. I want to see exactly what the LIV Golf experience has to offer. It's in my home state, and it's within driving distance, so I'm going to give it a chance.
I do want to make sure that you bring earplugs, because they do say it's golf, but louder.
That might be the highlight of the video I put out on YouTube for this experience going to LIV Golf, is how loud really does the music get? I'm going to test that volume.
Download an app on your phone that gets you like a decibel reader, so we can see how loud it is at LIV Houston.
Good call out. So decibel reader, and then I need to get the video of me getting sprayed with champagne from the winning team as they spray their bottle all over me. That's the quota for this Sunday in Houston, Texas.
It's going to be,
Yeah, I have no clue what to expect. Honestly, you know, you and I have kind of joked about the whole LIV Golf experience for years now, but I'm gonna get the front row seat. I'm gonna document it all for everyone. We'll have it up on the YouTube channel, and we'll be posting a bunch on our Instagram at COL Podcast and Course of Life Alex to see what it's like going to a LIV Golf event.
Coming up next for the PGA Tour is that warm up to the U.S. Open. U.S. Open, of course, will be at Pinehurst, and we may see carnage at Pinehurst. I really hope we do.
Yep.
Where they're going to be in Dublin, Ohio. They'll be at the Memorial at Muirfield. Always a great event.
Winner shakes Jack's hand at the end.
Yeah.
Tradition like any other. Great 18th green there at Muirfield. This is always a tricky test, and Jack and his crew make it a point to make it one of the more difficult non-major tests. So always good to see a great field is going to be aligned here. It's a signature event. It leads up to a major. The best in the world are all aligned. Definitely a trophy you want to get your hands on in a moment you want to have at 18, shaking hands with Jack Nicklaus himself by the green there. So, you tell me who you like at the top of the board, but all the best are going to be there. So it's a fully locked and loaded this field this week.
I mean, do we think Victor can return to form and just make it happen and repeat?
Yeah. So that and it's funny you mentioned that. As soon as you said Victor winning last year, I just remember him making a lot of putts. You know, these greens are fast. They're going to be a good precedent for the U.S. Open the week after next. Because they stimp them out real hard. They're going to get crusty and brown. So it's a putting contest at the end, specifically this week on those last few greens. And Victor made the putts when he needed to. He hasn't been doing that recently. So we'll see if he can refine a little bit of that magic this week at Muirfield Village.
Let's do a little tuned in. It was an interesting week this last week, Alex. I feel like across the board, I was sitting down on Thursday trying to get your YouTube video up.
That's
on our YouTube.
Right. And I was grocery shopping walking through HEB, actually.
Yeah. And I sent you a text. And I was like, hey, I'm working on this, but I'm going out to dinner and it's going to have to wait because now I'm sitting in front of the TV watching the guilty verdict of Donald Trump in New York come in.
Yeah, that was a crazy unfolding, to be honest. 34 or nothing there on the verdict count. And what made it all crazier is just the feverish pitch that emerged after in the hours and days to follow. You flip your computer on as a sports fan hours later, and you see him at the UFC fight. Mike, that man walks out like he is The Rock or Stone Cold Steve Austin returning from the dead to WWE. He got one of the loudest pops I'd ever seen in my life. I mean, obviously that's quite literally his crowd that he's playing to, but unprecedented decibel levels. You want to talk decibel levels, Trump walking out of UFC. That was some volume this past weekend.
Well, he's got a lot more free time now. He doesn't have to be sitting in court every day. So we'll see how many more pops he can get at different arenas. That is true.
I mean,
rallies.
Who says he's not going to show up in Houston this week for the LIV Golf event, right? You know what
he
I mean?
Would.
Like
He's got
a couple tee times this week. You know that. Yeah. Over under golf rounds, Donald Trump this week, over under is 2.5. He's definitely hitting the course a couple times now that the schedule's freed up. It's not like he's campaigning or he's got anything that he's running for at all. So, I mean, it's all golf for Trump from here on out, yeah. I think.
I would slam that over so much. But like we said, too, on our YouTube channel, we got a video out where you can see how much of a pop there is with Tiger Woods when he's out on the course.
Yes.
We've been saying this every week. He is the needle. He continues to be the needle on the PGA Tour, even
like
though
it or
he
not.
Can't walk like he used to walk. He can't play anywhere near like he used to be able to play. it's not happening, but it doesn't matter. This is Tiger freaking Woods here, yep. And people are still going to buy $200 polos from his new brand.
That's right. Shout out Sunday Red. We love our friends at Sunday Red as well, too. Yes. So, yeah, this week on the YouTube, it's the Tiger walkout, walking with Tiger Woods in a major championship. If you ever wanted to do it or experience it, you don't even have to buy a ticket. You can just go to our YouTube page, Course of Life Podcast, and check it out. And then we're going to have the final installation from my trip to Frisco, the Visit Frisco vlog dropping, Mike, with not much golf. This is all the life and everything cool you can do at Frisco, from visiting the Star to checking out neat hole-in-the-wall restaurants and tourist attractions as well, plus my stay at the Westin, which is an awesome property. So if you're considering a stay in Dallas, we'll talk basketball later. Maybe you're going to the NBA Finals. Frisco could be the place for you. So be sure to check out our YouTube page for all that video.
Let's get to this week's guest, who has a tie-in with Tiger Woods.
Yes.
Probably one of the best tie-ins or the best outcome to a tie-in with Tiger Woods of all the guests we've had who has had these kind of Tiger stories. And that's Billy Mayfair, five-time PGA Tour winner. And he shares some really great stories with you, Alex, and things that he's working on now. But I feel like the thing that really resonates with our childhood with Billy Mayfair is him being the only player to beat Tiger Woods in a playoff.
Yes, and he breaks that entire moment down, what the winning putt was like, what the feeling of going head-to-head with a young Tiger was like, and everything that he's up to on and off the golf course here with a five-time PGA Tour winner in Billy Mayfair. Next up on the tee from the Valley in Arizona, he is a five-time PGA Tour winner with some fascinating experience both in the game of golf and the game of life. It's Billy Mayfair joining us here on The Course of Life. Billy, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good, Alex. Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's great to have you on. Grew up watching you play on tour. You're still on the PGA Tour champions now. Tell everyone a little bit about what your kind of playing schedule is like these days out on the PGA Tour champion circuit.
Well, it's actually pretty busy right now. We're home this week. We're off because of the PGA Championship there at Valhalla, but we have our PGA Championship next week up in Michigan. So we're kind of excited about that. And then we go to Iowa after that and back up to Steve Stricker's tournament up there in Minneapolis. So our schedule now is pretty full until about the end of August. So we're going full bore.
Yeah, that's a fun Midwest stretch in that time of the year. And those are some great events that we'll be seeing on television in the weeks to come as well, too. I'm curious what this experience is like for you now, you know, settling into the PGA Tour champions after having a great run out on the main tour. What's that camaraderie like for you guys out there, kind of facing old friends that you went to battle with back in the day as well?
Well, it's a lot of fun. It's obviously it's very competitive. We all want to play well and do well. You know, at the end of the day, we go in and have a drink or we talk to things and talk to each other and want to help each other out. Like I said, we're a small little family. You know, most of the guys I've known since I was about 10, 11 years old. So it's actually, you know, Alex, it's a lifesaver in a way because we're so used to playing the big tour. We're used to playing every week, playing, traveling and all that. And if you just kind of take that away from us completely, a lot of people have problems. So I play a lot on the senior tour, but even if you just played 15, 16 events on it, it just kind of keeps you active, keeps you something to do. And as my famous saying, it gets me out of that honey-do list for one more week, you know?
So that's right. Yeah. Some awesome travel. You guys hit some great spots in the game as well too, on the PGA Tour champions.
We do. And the fans are great. And I think they enjoy being around us because they've known us for so long. And I said, like I said, it's still very competitive, but we have a lot of fun out there too.
Yeah, I've covered the event in Naples, Florida, the Chubb Classic, and I've seen the celebrity invited event in the Dallas, Las Colinas area there. And there's some really cool places. The thing I like that the PGA Tour Champions does, and you'll appreciate this too, is they're starting to, you know, re-rotate and bring in a lot of past PGA Tour venue courses that fans yes. of the 80s and 90s and 2000s want to see again. So I enjoy kind of reliving that, just as I imagine you guys do too.
We do too. Obviously, anytime you get to go to some place where you've played and some places, even when Ally took over, I got to go back to Warwick Hills where I won the Buick Open. So when you get to go back to those places and see everybody again, it's a lot of fun.
Very cool. Yeah. So your PGA Tour career began when you turned pro in 1988. Let's flash back to that. And now think about where the game and where the PGA Tour is in 2024. The differences in how the game looked when you turned pro versus the way it is now.
Well, I mean, when I turned pro, there's still wood woods. I mean, we didn't have the metal woods yet. We had golf balls that weren't anything like they are today. And the golf courses were a lot shorter. I mean, they weren't very long. And there's still a premium to hit it straight and hit good golf shots. And you had to hit it pretty pure out there with some of the equipment that was there. Yeah. But, you know, again, it still comes down to a short game. And who can putt the best is usually going to be the guy who wins. And you get a guy like Bernhard Langer, who's 62 years old, and he's had every type of putting issue there is, and he's a great wedge player, and he makes a lot of putts, and even at 62, he's competitive.
That's awesome to see. He's an Iron Man. We love showcasing his dominance. I know you wouldn't mind him maybe taking another week or two off it, but yeah, it's awesome to see what he's doing out there. And
well, we had a chance for that this year with his Achilles going out, which was unfortunate. Yeah. But he's out of Houston, and you know he's good to be out there. He's good for the tour, and I love hanging around him. So I'm glad he's back out.
That's awesome. You obviously, you know, you played right through the tour through the 90s into that magical moment when a guy named Tiger Woods arrived on the scene. I've had some different interviews with guys in your era. One most notably, John McGinnis, told a great story about the first time he saw Tiger hit a ball at the BC Open. I'm just curious what your early memories are of Tiger the first time you saw him on the course.
Well, you know, in that time of year, every year there was supposed to be a new hot shot coming out, new kid coming out. Ty Tryon was, you know, there for a while. Everyone talked about he was going to come out there. So when Tiger came out, you know, yeah, you heard, okay, well, he's Tiger Woods and that's nice. And, you know, but, you know, he's still not going to live up to what everybody says. And right. I watched him play in Milwaukee and there was a difference there. There was just the way he looked and the way he walked. He was very, very gracious and very nice to me all the time. He's never been anything like that, which is very difficult when you have someone pulling at you all the time, as people do. But you could tell. And then when he went to Vegas and won at Las Vegas, I think his second week out, you know, maybe this kid's got something here. And he's definitely lived up to all the expectations. That's for sure.
Yeah, he has indeed.
And he's helped the game out. And you got to remember something too, how much he's helped the game of golf out. I mean, golf was just, you know, he made golf cool. You know, people don't realize that. I mean, a lot of people and a lot of kids out there who would have never started playing golf got started because of Tiger Woods. And he's helped the game of golf just so tremendously. It's great.
Yeah. And I was at that pivotal age of 10 years old, seeing him win in 97 at the Masters. Like, you can imagine how impressionable that was for everyone in my generation, obviously. Absolutely. Yeah. So we build Tiger up just to say that we do have Billy Mayfair on, because you do have one up on Tiger Woods, which you'll always have. For people who don't know, Billy actually clipped a young Tiger Woods at Riviera in a playoff on the PGA Tour, making yourself the only person to beat Tiger in a playoff. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah. It was not, we were not at Riviera that year. The Riviera was hosting the PGA Championship. So we were at Valencia.
So it was the LA Open, but it was a different course.
It was a different off course, which was actually more special one, because I have the only money clip that says Valencia on it, which I'm very proud to say. But more importantly to me, it's where Tiger grew up. So we were really in his backyard when I beat him there. So he's let me know that a few times, trust me. So
let's take everyone back to that moment, like putt to win in a playoff and beat Tiger Woods. How much, just, you know, from a memory standpoint, what sticks out to you from those moments of that win?
Well, I remember I had to birdie the last hole. I had to get it up and down from the bunker on the 72nd hole in order to get in the playoff. I made about a 10 footer there to get in the playoff. And most people thought, since we were going back to 18, which was a par five, that Tiger definitely had the advantage on me. And all I wanted to do was I wanted to get to 10. I wanted to get past 18 and go to 10, which was a par four, which I thought maybe I had a better chance. But when Tiger unfortunately hit a drive a little bit right, I knew he couldn't go for the green in two. And I said, okay, well, let's see what can happen here. And I didn't hit a very good drive. I had to lay up about 80 yards short, but, you know, it was right in my wheelhouse. And I hit a little wedge shot in there that went past the hole and spun back about 6 feet. And fortunately, it spun back 6 feet and was almost on the same identical line that I hit the putt to go in the playoff.
There you go.
I knew what the putt was going to do and all that. And Tiger had missed the green to the right. He hit a real good wedge shot up there about 20 feet. And, try to slow play me a little bit. He was looking at that hole for a long time and all that, but I knew what the putt did. And one of the few times when he had to make a putt, he actually missed this one just on the top edge. And I said, okay, you know what this is going to do. Let's just make it. And when it went in, you know, it wasn't so much that I beat Tiger Woods. It was that I won a PGA Tour event.
Right.
And not only that, but winning a PGA Tour event on the West Coast meant that I actually had almost a 3-year exemption now. Out there on the PGA Tour. I had the rest of that year and two more. So that was a huge, huge thing for me to do. But it wasn't probably until the next week when I got to Doral, when the media room was about 500 people from the press there talking about beating Tiger, that I realized, hey, I might've done something here, you know? So, but you know, it was a thrill. It's been 20 years since that's happened. And I still get asked it every day, and I'm very proud of it. And I think my wife's going to make my tombstone the only player to beat Tiger Woods in a playoff. So it's very special to me. Trust me. I never get tired of talking about it.
Absolutely. No. And it's funny. Actually, it's a callback to a guest we've had before on the show as well, who has a different, he was on the wrong end of Tiger Woods, but it was an experience that made his entire life what it was. And I'm referring to Steve Scott, who we've had on the show a couple of times, who Tiger played in that famous 36 hole amateur final. And, you know, he went on to an amazing career. Now he's in broadcasting and has a full PGA career of his own. And he's talked about just kind of that association with Tiger and just kind of how far that resonates with you for the rest of your life. Do you ever kind of think about just, you know, how you're going to be uniquely tied to him for, you know, the rest of the history of the game?
It does. Like I said, people talk to me about it every day. But the one, well, the one special thing that I had over Steve was that I only had to play him one hole. He had to play him 36, and he almost beat him with 36, and that was a huge accomplishment, especially back then. But I was fortunate enough; I only had to beat Tiger on one hole. I only had to play with him one hole, and only had to beat him on one hole. So I was lucky for that.
Love it. Again, it's Billy Mayfair, PGA Tour vet. He's on the PGA Tour Champions now, joining us on The Course of Life. One thing I really do want to go ahead and applaud your candor for is something that you'd come out and been very direct about in recent years. You had a autism diagnosis that you received in 2019. For those who are wondering how that came about, explain the background and how you kind of came to that diagnosis a few years back.
Well, unfortunately, in 2019, at the end of the year, at the 3M Championship in California, I was disqualified on a ruling, and I didn't quite understand what had happened. And I don't want to say I didn't fight for myself, but I just kind of let it go. And it was not, it should not have been disqualified. It was the ruling was incorrect. I was in the right. They were in the wrong.
Interesting.
Unfortunately, the tour is not going to do anything about that, which is okay. But my wife had seen things in me before that, had seen some of my attitudes, some of my personality changes and all that. And she thought that I might be suffering some type of autism and all that. We had seen some neuropsychologists in Phoenix shortly after that. And she finally had me convinced that I probably needed to go get tested for this before the next year started. That would maybe help me. And of course, I fought tooth and nail. I did not like it. I was normal. Everybody else was different. So let people know that you're not going to get an easy fight for most people who you want to go get tested. Even after I was tested, it was a 1-day, 8-hour test. I got the results and I let them sit in my corner on my desk for about 3 months before I finally opened them up again. There was nothing wrong with me. Everybody else was wrong. And finally, my wife convinced me to open them up, and it really, it made things a lot clearer for me. It made me understand why I was good in school in some classes and why I wasn't. But I think the biggest thing that I was diagnosed with was high functioning autism, which for me, my two, just sometimes it just takes me a few extra minutes to understand a question, to get an answer out, it takes me maybe a few extra minutes to understand a person's facial expression, their facial IQ. Sometimes they say things to me and I don't catch up on the cue, and I sometimes can misunderstand or misquote it. And so sometimes I just need to just kind of take a second and realize that. But I think the biggest thing with it is it realizes that my brain is very well at focusing on certain things. That's why golf was such a wonderful thing for me growing up. I could go to the golf course. I didn't need a team. I didn't need a coach. I could go out to the golf course, hit balls and chip and putt and play all by myself and be in my own little world, which was wonderful, wonderful for me. And now that I've gotten more into autism and trying to help people out there, my wife, Tammy, and I realize how much of a blessing it is. And I'm very blessed that coaches, college coaches, high school coaches, CEO companies are realizing that people who are diagnosed with high functioning autism have a very keen focus on certain things. They can do very meticulous things. They do it very well. They'll do it right. If you ever watch that TV show, The Big Bang Theory, Sheldon Cooper, I'm a little bit.
Oh, like absolutely. Him. Yeah. And it's funny because this young Sheldon spinoff just came to a conclusion all these years as well, too. And it diagnoses an entire life of like a high functioning autistic personality.
With a personality. And sometimes I look at that and start laughing. Like, huh, crap. I was just like that, you know, and you don't realize. And sometimes you just have to realize that it's not what I try to go out. And I talk to a lot of kids and parents about it, is that it's not that that you have a handicap. It's that you've been given a special gift, that your brain is able to hyper focus a lot better than most other people's. And I think, as I said, teachers are understanding this more. The coaches, which are the biggest blessings, and presidents of companies, that these are some, for some of the jobs they have, this is the type of person they want. So I go out and try to tell kids that this is not a handicap. This is to encourage them. But my wife, Tammy, and I are not only trying to help the high functioning autism athlete, we're also trying to help the siblings, the wives, the girlfriends, the grandparents and all that, who have no help out there and they're kind of drowning. So we're trying to help them a little bit to understand the disease, trying to understand how to help them and not just help the child who has it, but the other siblings in the family. So they're right, not ignored or unrecognized and all that, which you see a lot of. But it's such a wonderful thing to give back to kids, to help them. And when you tell them that just because you have this, you can be normal, you have a normal life, you can have anything, you can do anything you want, you can marry, you can have kids, you can do anything you want. And when they hear that from someone, just how their face lights up, and not only do their face light up, but so do their parents. And that's the greatest eagle putt you're ever going to make out there.
Nice. So, very well said.
It's been very wonderful for Tammy and I to do it. We're still in the process of getting things set up and all that, but BillyMayfair.org, you can go on and learn more about me. But it's just something that's helped me kind of give back the game. And as I'm finding out that people with autism, there's a lot more people out there, and it's just not as uncommon as people think it is sometimes. And when you run into someone and you can help them a little bit and help them understand, like I said, it's the greatest feeling in the world.
Very well said, Billy. And there's a couple different ideas that I've seen you talk about, and I appreciate how candidly you speak about this, because it helps everyone get educated on exactly what autism is, because it can be a mystery to lots of people. And you talked about the idea of helping the support system as well, too, and how autism can be like speaking a different language. So break down what that means and how, you know, you help make the support system more hospitable and accommodating to people with autism.
Well, and that's a great point. When most people think that you have autism, they think of Rain Man. They think of the main movie Rain Man. And even in that, you could see his abilities to focus on playing cards.
Yeah.
You know, and that type of deal. And what we try to encourage is that you have your kids with golf or with school, art, music, something like that, where they can really focus hard on that, and they will hyper-focus.
Harness the creativity. Yeah.
That's harness creativity and to leave them alone, you know, that's the hardest thing. And, but to encourage them to do something like that, where they can be that real, do that one task that a lot of people just can't do, and they can do it so much better. And they're good at that. And that's what they've been blessed with. And that's why I tell these kids that you are blessed with this. This is not a handicap. This is a blessing, and please use it as a blessing. And then to try to help the parents understand it better, to encourage them and to help them help even the siblings and their family understand it better, so that everybody can get along, can have a healthy, safe life together.
Very well said. I appreciate that, Billy. And the one other thing that I wanted to touch on is you mentioned the idea about how, you know, you're kind of understanding that your brain is wired differently. And this is something you just yes. now came to a conclusion when you got the diagnosis. When you look back, you know, you said looking back, you know, you got some answers. Is that more, do you regret not knowing earlier in life, or do you have kind of more clarity now, just looking back and having a more clear picture of the way your life was and how it unfolded? What's that mix there of emotions?
That's such a great question, because I've thought about it too. Cause I struggled in school. I liked going to school. I liked the classes and all that. And there were some teachers and some classes I did wonderful in and got A's in, and there's others I just struggled in. And I think back, if I would have known what I know now, I could have dropped those particular professors and got a different one. And I could have taken a different class or a different way where I wasn't beat up because of it. And of course, back then, a lot of teachers didn't accept this. It wasn't accepted and all that, which I can understand. But I guess the biggest thing is I a lot of times I'd go back and, you know, I wasn't good in school. I didn't do this. And you criticize yourself, or you get down on your foot. But that's not your fault. It's just the way your brain works. Mm-hmm. And there's certain things that your brain will pick up on and run with. And there's just certain things that it won't do. But I still struggle every day with facial expressions with people. They say something to me, and sometimes I interpret it a little bit differently. And I also know it's okay to just, you know, if someone says and asks me a question, it's okay to take a second or two and say, you know, just let me think about this for a second.
Sure.
And give you a response back. And most people are very understanding about that. And, you know, as I said, 98% of all the people out there are very understanding. They get it. It seems like anymore that anyone you talk to, they're affected by this disease somehow. Either they have a loved one or someone in their family that has autism. There's still that little percentage out there that people who just don't want to accept it. And that's okay. That's what the world's about. But we're really trying to make a difference. And like I said, this is my way of giving back to golf and for all the people who helped me and done what I've done in my career, to help them now a little bit is a huge thing for me.
Well said. Again, Billy Mayfair here on The Course of Life. It's billymayfair.org if you want to learn more about the story and his background as well. Let's get to some golf-related fun questions here. Let's talk about life on the PGA Tour Champions. Give me a little bit of flashback. Tell me like who your buddies are that you do the practice rounds with on a week-to-week basis out there. Who are you hanging out with these days?
Well, you always try to find guys that you went to school with, or you were, or, you know, I went to Arizona State. So I get, you know, I have guys from the Pac-10, you know, Brant Job, Corey Pavin, you know, guys that you were, nice. You know, you played golf with. I used to, I went out to when Corey was at UCLA, I went and watched him play in a college event and all that. And so, you know, to be out here still now playing with those guys. So there's a bond there. It's unfortunately for these kids who go right from high school to the pros, they don't have that. I think college is the best 4 years, 5 years of your life.
Right.
I think that is wonderful. And I encourage anyone, the tour is not going anywhere, even with all the problems right now with the tour and LIV and all that, the tour is not going anywhere. It's going to be there for you. Enjoy, go to college, enjoy it. It'd be the best times of your life. You're going to meet friends there forever. But I hang around, you know, you hang around with guys you did in college.
And yeah. Very well said. Love hearing the name Corey Pavin. We'll always remember that moment at Shinnecock with his four wood from the fairway. Awesome to hear.
I'll tell you when he was at college at UCLA, he missed a three putted one of the greens and he threw his putter and broke it. And I still remember that. And he does too. And so it hasn't changed. He hasn't changed over the years. So, you know, I got him on that one. So
great to hear. Billy, we're coming up on US Open season right now. I know you had an impressive finish of your own and top five at Bethpage. I'm curious, what do you like or maybe enjoy about the grind of the USGA setup? And what's kind of the key to succeeding at a US Open?
Well, you know, it's going to be harder. You know, it's going to be set up to the extreme. I think Pinehurst is a wonderful, wonderful venue. I think Los Angeles Country Club last year was something different. I thought it was wonderful for the Open, but you know, I'd like to see the USGA get back to a little bit higher rough. They're a little bit tighter fairways. And the best thing about even this week at Valhalla is that par is a good score. Par should be a good score. And you don't want to see the US Open champion or even the PGA champion win at 19, 20 under par. And I don't think that will happen, especially at Pinehurst. But the great thing about Pinehurst is that you can hit a lot of good shots there and the balls can roll off the greens, roll off to the side and all over. And when I played there, luckily it rained a little bit, so it was a little bit softer. If they don't get any rain and get some sunshine and some wind there, it can get really tough. But I've always liked the majors and especially the US Opens because par is a very, very good score.
Yeah, well said. Pinehurst is going to be a fun watch indeed. Billy, I know that you've often joked that you're kind of like a Trivial Pursuit question answer. And that really resonates with me because I'm like the guy that goes with my wife to the trivia night at bars all the time. So I could totally picture the name, the only golfer to beat Tiger Woods in a playoff question coming up. I'm curious, if you go out to the bar for trivia, what are like your favorite categories? What trivia categories are you good at?
Well, I love sports. I watch Jeopardy all the time and I love all these smart people can't answer, you know, what conference is Alabama in?
Oh, yes.
But they answer something about an Egyptologist.
What is the Ivy League would be their answer?
What's the Ivy League? Yeah, exactly. And all that. So I love college sports. I love college football. So I'm always into that type of trivia. I love college. I love hanging around with the coaches and getting to know them and all that. As I said, I love when I went to school. School was so much fun for me, even though I didn't do good in the classroom. But I just encourage all these kids that want to turn pro and all that to go and play college golf. Enjoy those 4 years. It's just a great part of your life and time in your life. And don't mess with it because the tour, professional sports is always going to be there. So just enjoy it while you can.
No, well said indeed. All right, Billy, we love to wrap up with our 19th hole question. It's our favorite question to ask at every interview. So let's say you get into your favorite clubhouse, you had a good day on the course, and it's time to order a meal and a drink at the 19th hole. What are you usually going with?
I'm going to probably, I'm real favorite to Mexican food.
Nice. I'm in Austin, Texas, so I'm very biased to Mexican food as well. So.
Yeah. You're more Tex-Mex than I am, but I love Mexican food with a couple of cheese enchiladas, a burrito, and you got to have a daiquiri. So, you know, that's a perfect meal for me.
That's a nice fit. I like that vibe indeed. Billy, thank you so much for hopping on the Course of Life and sharing your story with us, and looking forward to following you the rest of the season on the PGA Tour Champions, and hit them straight out there. All right.
Hey, thank you so much. Thanks for having me on, Alex.
Course of Life podcast is brought to you by Zencastr. We've been using Zencastr here since almost the very beginning, as how Alex and I record this podcast from hundreds of miles away. And it provides us with great quality audio that works every time. And it's something that makes Course of Life what it is and has kept us being able to make consistent episodes every week. And now it's super easy to record a podcast with Zencastr. You log in using your browser and start recording a high-quality podcast right away. You record studio-quality sound and up to 4K video with your guests. You feel a sense of zen knowing Zencastr's multi-layered backups ensure you always have your recordings in the highest quality, even if the connection is unstable. And have you ever wondered what you actually sound like? Zencastr's post-production process makes you sound buttery smooth. It automatically removes those ums and ahs in your recording. It removes those awkward pauses in conversation too. Set the right podcast loudness and levels while reducing background noise with the click of a button. Head on over to zencastr.com/pricing and use our promo code COURSEOFLIFE to get 30% off your first month of any Zencastr paid plan. We want you to have the same easy experiences we do for all of your podcasting and content needs. Again, that's zencastr.com/pricing and our promo code COURSEOFLIFE. Zencastr, it's time to share your story. And we're back. Great chat there with Billy Mayfair. I really love to hear how much he's working to normalize autism.
Yes.
In all its different forms, the full spectrum of it, how much he's embraced this diagnosis that he has, and how he's trying to really give back and help other people see how just because you have autism doesn't mean you can't still live your life.
Absolutely. And I hope those are answers to realistic, normal questions coming from my perspective, just trying to learn what that spectrum is like and how that communication is day to day with someone who is working through their life with autism, no matter where they sit on the spectrum. So fascinating perspective from a guy, Mike, who'd been really in our life for a while. You know, you and I kind of like had a funny little moment. We're like, wow, Billy Mayfair is on our podcast. This is a guy we've been watching play the game for 3 decades, and it's awesome to hear him share his perspective with us in the Course of Life.
And if you like that conversation with Billy Mayfair plus everything else we do here on this podcast, make sure you punch that subscribe button on the podcast app you're using right now, and then go to the podcast app you don't use as often, but you have on your phone, because I have like a backup app.
Yep.
That's just kind of there, and subscribe on that one too, because then it shows you like us even more. Leave us a rating, 4 stars, leave us a review. It just means the world to us. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. And that podcast is that purple app on the iPhone that you may not use very often, but that's a great place to find us in addition to wherever you found us now. So cheers.
All right. Let's talk about the WNBA, Alex. Okay. Let's talk about the first WNBA rookie to record 150 points, 50 rebounds and 50 assists in 10 games. That would be Caitlin Clark.
Okay, nice. Yep. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Caitlin Clark, moving the game forward, moving women's sports forward, getting unprecedented audiences to the WNBA right now.
And I think she's getting so much attention that the players on other teams of the WNBA have instituted a bounty on her
shout out to the New Orleans Saints with the bounty there.
Yeah, she's getting like borderline first degree assault every yes. single game.
It really, I'm laughing, right, but it now. Really, it really is a bounty. It's like,
I mean, the hit on her just the other day from Kennedy Carter of the Chicago Sky. This, you know, which looked like this off the ball foul, which should have been a flagrant, and she should be ejected and suspended for like a week. This foul was so bad,
and it took league review just to get that to a flagrant foul.
Yeah,
after the fact,
unbelievable.
Yeah, it's insane what's happening. And the part that really bugs me is I feel like the perspective is lost with all these veteran NBA players. Maybe they feel these WNBA players maybe feel like their ground is stepped on by Caitlin Clark and what she's doing in her impact. Maybe they feel envy or jealousy for the amount of attention or accolades she's currently receiving. But what they need to realize is from a greater perspective, when you look at the big picture, Caitlin Clark is doing things for your sport that you currently play competitively and professionally that no one else has ever done. She is taking you from commercial planes to charter planes.
Yes.
She is taking you from empty stadiums to full stadiums.
Yes.
And for you to clothesline and cheap shot Caitlin Clark, and then after the game in the press conference say, I'm not taking any Caitlin Clark questions. That is the definition of immature and not understanding the situation at hand. But I had to get that off my chest.
It's, I think... More, are you more pissed at the players or are you pissed off at the coaches for allowing this to happen?
Yeah, I mean, that is an interesting way to think about it. I'm first just going at the players because I know it's just the players' jealousy of her. They're just envious of the stage that she's been put on. They think that she doesn't deserve it. They think that she is not deserving of it for whatever reason they have. But what they have to understand is her impact is having an impact greater than they could ever imagine any entrant player would have in this league. Mm-hmm. So they need to roll with who she is. They need to treat her just like any other player on the court. And they don't need to have a bounty on her, which it seems like they do have right now. So I hope they still play her hard. You can play tight defense on Caitlin Clark. You can prevent her from shooting a million threes, but you don't have to cheap shot her at every corner.
Here's my other question. If this had happened, let's say back on, I don't know, Steph Curry, when he entered the NBA.
Okay,
if
10 years ago.
If these kind of fouls had happened on Steph Curry in the NBA, how would the NBA have responded to this? Because it's, you know... It is like, where's the response from the league?
Yeah, it's interesting because when you actually frame that question to me, I think the NBA wouldn't really react that swiftly to something like that. And I think they would say, yep, that's just, you know, welcome to the league, rookie. It's going to be tough. Mm. And I think that's what a lot of the veteran WNBA players who are casting that jealousy are currently feeling right now. That's kind of the quandary of the situation. So very curious to see how these are treated from, like you said, both the players, but also the opposing coaches and the league as well, too, moving forward.
On the men's side of the basketball, the NBA Finals are about to kick off. The Boston Celtics and the Dallas Mavericks. The Celtics, the biggest juggernaut in the league, the most potent offense and a very good defense as well. They embarrass teams. Is this series going to be over in four games?
Oh my God. What a thought. I mean, I'm on the fence right now, Mike, because we're weighing the idea of going to game four in Dallas versus game six.
Oh, yeah.
Do I go to the game four knowing that that's guaranteed to happen? Or do I sit and wait and really, you know, think this is going to be a competitive series and sit and wait for the game six experience because game six could be something even more epic. That's the quandary I'm in right now. But yeah, I mean, the honest prediction is Celtics in six. I'd love to be there for the game six win in Dallas. So we'll see if that could come true. But I just know Kyrie Irving and Luka are going to make it difficult. But game one Thursday night should be a good series to watch.
It's going to be an excellent series. The other thing that's really fun to pay attention to right now, and we are recording this podcast early on a Sunday evening, so hopefully by the time you all are listening to this, this is still true.
Still a great story, regardless.
It's a great story. We have to talk about Birmingham Southern.
Maybe the only time we mentioned Birmingham Southern on this podcast.
Well, it's certainly after this, you know, after this year will be the last time we ever mentioned Birmingham Southern. D3 Men's World Series, College World Series. All right. Birmingham Southern has no school. This team doesn't have a school anymore. The school has literally shut its doors and will never open again.
Wow.
They ran out of money. They knew this at the beginning of the calendar year.
Yep.
And the team decided to keep playing hard.
Last season, play it out. Yep.
This baseball miracle, for lack of a better term, continued on Saturday night when they hit a walk-off home run to continue in the bottom of the ninth, in the ninth inning, to beat Randolph-Macon in a thrilling 9-7 comeback win. They continue in the Division III World Series, these elimination games. This is just crazy.
That's so cool. So the baseball program has outlasted the university for yes. which the baseball program represents.
Yes. If they That's win a trophy, I don't, I guess they're just going to pass it around the players every year.
Where does the trophy go? That's a fantastic question.
And it's worth pointing out, Brigham and Southern is a good baseball team. They were in the 2019 World Series.
Okay.
And, you know, so this is a good team.
Wow.
Historically good team. And they're going for it again here. But this school, which opened in 1856.
Dang, a lot of history there. Its doors. That's kind of sad. Jeez. This is one last legacy for the same team. So I do like that story. That's a nice one.
It is indeed. So we'll see next week. They'll see if they're still in it. But certainly a huge story and pretty awesome to see. So these guys, good for these guys for keeping it going. All right, let's hashtag always end with food.
Yep, 19th hole content to wrap up the podcast at always end with food if you want to see our food content there. And I just did a reel which is collaborated on by my friends, my local bar here, our friends at Bonaire ATX, Mike. And I've shouted them out before because you remember me talking about the absurdly cheap and awesome bar food at Bonaire. This menu is like from 1985. They have a half pound $3.99 cheeseburger, which is amazing. 10 shrimp, 39 cents each for $3.90. We got a side of fries for $3. It's amazing prices. Toasted ravioli, $4.99. Mike, this is the best bar food you're ever going to find. I challenge anyone in the comments at Always End With Food to tell me a better bar food deal wherever they are, because I'm absolutely hooked on these deals, especially in these tough times. It's great to see some good cheap food prices.
It does seem like inflation has passed them over. My question, though, is how much is a beer?
More expensive than most of the food items.
Because
they
are a bar somewhere.
And they do make money on their alcohol, as we all know.
So. Yeah.
But the food keeps us coming back. So shout out to Bonaire. And again, check out Always End With Food on Instagram if you want to see a glimpse of a little more of this food content that we bring up here on The Course of Life.
I want to talk as we finish the food here about collard greens, Alex.
Yeah.
Now, okay. You and I are both very good northern boys.
We are. Yes.
I didn't grow up with any kind
of
greens.
The concept of collard greens is something I had heard by name growing up, but never, ever actually seen it made or executed until I was an adult.
It's just not something you think about, I think, at all. But I went just the other night with my mother, who's in town. We went out to Common here in Savannah, which you've been to their sister restaurant, Ordinary Pub.
I did. Yep. Down in the basement. Great burger.
So we went to Common and I got something that I've gotten there before, which is just I'm so glad I got it, which is their short rib. It's a braised short rib, a coffee whiskey glaze. Sesame seeds, creamed collard greens, cornbread, and a red wine jam.
Yeah.
And this is the collard greens are just so freaking delicious in this
smooth.
Dish.
Smooth is the word that's coming to my mind.
I can't, like, the dish is just freaking unbelievable as it is. The cornbread is almost like a Johnny cake or something, really, because it kind of is. It's not dry like cornbread. It's crispy on the edges. It's just incredible. But the collard green, the cream collard greens, when they get together with everything, there's just that little bit of bitterness in them. But it's just, I don't think I would ever make collard greens, but I will go back to Common and order this and eat those collard greens and clean that plate every day.
Love that. The amalgamation, the Southern soul food, the low country vibe. That's a great Savannah plate there. Love to hear that. Again, Always End With Food to check out more of that. And at COL Podcast on Instagram. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's Course of Life podcast. We'll see you next week.